This is Near FM
90.3.
I am joined now on the line by regular contributor Alan Tuffrey. Good afternoon, dear boy. How are we?
Well, the morning is very well, thank you, Donny. Yes, it's a great world if you ignore the weather, which we should do.
Yes, as a very intelligent man said one time, we'd be a great country if we could only roof it.
We should have done when we thought we had the money.
Yeah, well, we can kiss goodbye to that plan, I think.
Yeah, I don't expect to live to see that one, all right, yeah.
We are going to talk about something today which has been perplexing humankind, I think, since the dawn of time. And the dawn of time, I think, gives away what we're going to talk about, maybe.
All of the above. I have to say, I probably should issue a health warning here to our listeners. Evolution is a favourite topic of mine, and I've been thinking and talking about evolution as it applies to humans. Not so much human evolution, although that's a very exciting story these days, but the implications of it for the way we view ourselves and our world. So really, that's the kind of direction I want to take. Now, if I'd known you had a couple of gaps this morning, I could have done the hour and a half for you. But there you go. You're probably best for everybody that we didn't do it that way. So 20 minutes will be quite long enough. Yeah, I think evolution has been described as the best idea ever. And I must say, I'm struggling to think of a better one. It's a favourite topic. But I think it's made such a huge difference to the whole of biology. And when I say the whole of biology, that's not just... Biology isn't just a subject you do at school. It's everything, including us. We're part of biology. In fact, almost everything is part of biology. Again, I'd have to think hard to think of something isn't part of biology in one way or another. But that's being greedy, perhaps. So the idea of evolution is... In one sense, it's quite simple. Just to go back to dear old Charlie Darwin, who published his book, he got a bit of a frightener and thought somebody else was going to publish before him. So he rushed his book out as a preliminary note, all 400 and something pages of it, in 1859, Origin of Species. And this principle of evolution is very simple. That descent with modification is what he called it. That is to say, children are very like their parents, but they are not identical to their parent. In other words, there are differences. Some of those differences and various traits are inherited. That's the second point. And there is his third point, and perhaps the key one, and his great insight, is that there is a struggle for resources, what he called the struggle for existence, competition for resources, food, water, and crucially, mates, to have children with or offspring with. So those things together lead for what he called, eventually got around to calling, natural selection, or selection for fitness. Now, some of those ideas have been badly misused in the past, but what he meant by fitness is that organisms are better suited to their environment to thrive, do well, and leave offspring. So that's the basis of it. And that's not hard to grasp, and we can get that idea. Now, Darwin didn't just pluck this idea out of the air either. He didn't make this stuff up. The idea of evolution had been floating around for a couple of generations before Darwin. It wasn't popular, to say the least, but his own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, what a splendid name. Don't get many fellas called Erasmus nowadays, Donny. And anyway, Erasmus Darwin had published a great long poem where he'd spoken about what was then called transmutation, by which he meant essentially evolution. So the idea was around, but Darwin's great achievement was that he just amassed unbelievable amounts of evidence which he put together, and this is his achievement. He put it all together and came out with a coherent idea, which we call the theory of evolution. And he got evidence from everywhere. He was a great correspondent. The postal service was at its height in the 1840s and 50s. and because of the British Empire, he could write to people all around the world. And okay, it might take 2 months or more to get a reply, but he could write to people all around the world and gather data and expertise. And he also was a great man to talk to people like pigeon breeders who know about inheritance and selection and all of those things. And of course, famously, he went on the Beagle, his expedition on the Beagle, and saw the most amazing things and had the most wonderful experience. If you want to read one, Christmas is coming. I'm sorry to mention it quite so early, but if you haven't read...
And you were doing so well.
But I was going to mention a book, you see, and when at this time of year, when you mention a book, I more automatically think Christmas present time. So I'm not allowed to buy books at this time of the year because I have a birthday coming up and it's Christmas. So if I go and buy something, I probably scuppered somebody's plan for a birthday or Christmas present. So we have a rule that I can't buy anything after about the end of October. So books, the account of Darwin's voyage on the Beagle is just a terrific read. And I recommend Janet Brown's version. She's the chief biographer of Darwin ever. I mean, she's just superb. And his voyages in the Beagle and his journeys around South America and his social comments and everything else are just fascinating. Anyway, he published this theory of evolution. And before somebody says it, I can hear people saying, but it's only a theory. I probably should say that theory in science means something that is widely accepted. It doesn't mean an idea that is being tested, although it is being tested. All ideas are being tested. So theory means it's widely accepted. Darwin had a great handicap, and they didn't know anything about how inheritance worked. There was no knowledge of genetics in 1859. Indeed, there was no knowledge of genetics until nearly 60 years later. The work of that well-known monk in whichever country it was, probably Bohemia in those days, Mendel, his work didn't become discovered until about the 1900s. So there was no knowledge of genetics and how things were inherited until then. And that was the next 20 years were spent trying to make sense of that. So Darwin did extraordinarily well in the absence of any key knowledge about how things were inherited very well. And it wasn't until 1942, and I'm afraid I'm going to mention this name a few times, Julian Huxley, because he's one of several people in a very august family in science. He put together a book called The Modern Evolution, The Modern Synthesis, in 1942. And he put together the genetics and the ideas of Darwin, and they all put together, and that's when it really took off as an idea. And you can summarize the attitude to evolution in one quotation. It's a very short quotation by a fellow called Theodor Dobzhansky, who was initially very skeptical of the idea of evolution, but his own work and the work of others persuaded him he's right. And he finished up saying, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." In other words, it's a unifying idea, and I think that's a really that's perhaps the great achievement.
Alan, is there more involved here than what we're actually talking about now? This is a real complicated, stupid way of asking the question, but I'm going to do my best to make it simplify it. Insofar as, you know, if you can remember back to when you were sort of, 7, 8, 9 years of age, and the way things were then compared to the way they are now, is that a sort of an evolution, or is that progress, or where does progress cross the line into evolution, if you know what I mean? Like,
I do.
When I think of evolution, I think of the, and I presume you would be far too busy and intelligent to be looking at something like The Simpsons, but there was a clip shown, it used to be in the start of it one time, where the fish comes out of the sea, walks on land, and in the space of a brief couple of seconds transforms into Homer, has a look at himself in the mirror and decides he's going back into the sea again. But I mean, a lot of people, when they think of evolution, I presume that's what they would have in mind. But I mean, other things then? I mean, again, the question being, where does progress move to evolution, or does it?
Well, progress is a judgment is whether a change is for the better or for the worse, I suppose. At the moment, your first comparison, you know, the world is different now from when I was seven. That's by 1951. That's a long time ago. There was still rationing in place in Britain in 1951. The health service was just about in place, and various other good things, free milk for school kids and so on. So I think society, oh, well, of course, the previous decade had been one of war and serious shortages. So, yes, there is progress, but though that's a social or cultural progress. And I think that's a very important idea there, because the same Huxley, Julian Huxley, looked at evolution as having three major phases. I'll spare you the first two, which is everything except the last 2 million years, which is, 14 point something billion years. And the last 2 million years have involved something like humans. So we can say the first humans, recognizable humans, have been around for about 2 million years. And they've changed. We've become better at walking and talking, and probably slightly better at thinking. But like everything else, we've evolved physically. And we've probably evolved pretty much as far as we're going to go. We're probably at an end in terms of physical, biological evolution. But what we do have, and this is Huxley's major insight, I think, because we have language and we have writing and we have other means of transmitting information of all kinds, we can now change our societies and our cultures very much. He called this the psychosocial phase of evolution. Now, he's a grand man for creating new words. I think cultural is better, personally. And that means that our societies are themselves, and our institutions are also subject to natural selection. Just as a business that doesn't work in the commercial environment in which it finds itself, it will go bust, it will become extinct. So that's just an evolutionary model. So, and that happens, and everything is subject to selection pressures of one kind and another. So now, whether all changes are for the better, and in the last few years, it's been hard to say that they are, looking around at international affairs. But we have, the great thing is that we can choose, because we've got these enormous brains, which I've probably mentioned a few times before, we have these enormously complex brains, and we can decide, and we understand the future, and we know there is a past. We can ask questions. Like, if this happens, what then? And we can speculate. So this enables us to formulate goals. We can decide where we would like to go, what kind of society we would want, and in principle, what kind of world we want. And we can then decide to direct our actions towards those goals. You know, if we were properly organized, we could do that. And that's why there are advocacy groups out in society trying to change society in small ways to make everything a little bit better. And perhaps we're trying to do that too. And different people have different ideas of what is better, of course. But for Huxley, this was a crucial, absolutely crucial finding, because we are the only creatures on Earth, as far as we know, that can decide on how we want to direct our future. He liked to use the word destiny. I'm not terribly comfortable with that. And he used the phrase, humans are the sole agents of evolution. It's almost frightening phrase in its power. In other words, where we go from here is up to us. And that bears a little bit of thinking about. That's quite a daunting prospect.
Well, if we're to believe what we're being told, Alan, in relation to the climate crisis, where we're going, as a result of our action or inaction, depending which way you want to tell it, is back into oblivion.
Yes, we have not done very well, have we? We haven't. We haven't taken charge. We haven't foreseen the consequences of using our environment as a waste bin for the last 300 years, a phrase I've used before, I know. But that's what we've been doing, and we're still doing it. We're still using fossil fuels at a rate greater now than any time before, I think. So, we have not amended our ways when there were entirely foreseeable problems. That's what's so galling. People were talking about pollution in the environment and its effects 60 years ago, and we've done nothing in the meantime except continue to use the environment as a waste bin and keep burning fossil fuels and other smaller scale problems, which we've talked about before in other contexts. We haven't been very wise at solving that. And if we're to get out of this, we need to take charge. We need to say, look, we've got to get out of here. And I think everybody knows, everybody in the world knows at this stage, that if we continue burning fossil fuels at anywhere near the rate we're using fossil fuels, we're going to a proverbial place in a handcart. And it's not going to be very pretty right here in the next 30, 50 years.
And that is that's a real, worry, because, I mean, when you and I talk about evolution, okay, we're talking about, as you said, is it the 2 billion years before, or is it the 300 years since, or whatever? That's fine. Mm. And if you'll pardon my ignorance by being so flippant with my comment, two million years, so what? Big deal. 30 years, different game ball. Somebody who's 20 now will be only 50.
In their prime, yes, I would submit. In their prime. And if you live in some parts of some of the cities in this country, your house could be underwater. There was a map in the Irish Times at the weekend showing what would happen as various sea level rises, and it just happened to pick sort of Clontarf, North Bull, so within our bailiwick, if you like. And it shows that certain areas will be flooded with a very small rise in sea levels. At this stage, we know there's going to be a rise in sea levels over the next 20 or 30 years. And if things go really nasty in Greenland and Antarctica, it could be much more than that.
I think you meant to say much less than that.
Possibly.
Yeah.
No, it could be.
See right around, we'll say for argument's sake, the outer extremities of the planet, both on the north and the south poles. And, I mean, look, it's kind of going away from what we were talking about, but it really puts things in perspective in another way. In huge ice shelves are just falling into the sea and melting, and that is causing a rise in sea levels. That's without any extra rainfall.
That's exactly it. I mean, Greenland glacier there is just sliding into the sea. They're not getting the same snow falling anymore. That precipitation is now coming as rain. Well, that's not helping, because rain falling on ice melts more ice. So it's speeding the process. So it's not looking good. So we do need to escape. Climate change is a serious existential threat to humankind.
I put that point to you, Alan, by way of, I suppose, putting things into perspective, that it took us sort of, 2 million years to get to where we are. 20, 30 years could put us right back to where we came from and further back.
It could put us a very long way back, because the amount of conflict and strife that we're seeing it now with droughts and famines and floods. Poorer parts of the world simply can't feed their populations, and that's not going to get better. We're seeing it now. I mean, Jupiter, we had a fair old deluge this morning here, but that's nothing compared to what other parts of the world have had. But anyway, on the plus side, and I think that's because that's a gloomy prospect. Doesn't mean we should ignore it, but we need to do something about it. But the great thing about this view of humans, humans as being able to take charge of their destiny, if you like that word, is that individual humans become valued, because you've talked about the cosmic scale of things, or the scale of billions of years, where one individual life, one individual human life, is utterly trivial in that scale. I mean, it's a blink of an eye, if that. But on this evolutionary view, diversity is the key thing. And I don't mean diversity in the sort of modern use of it, you know, we need all sorts of different sorts of people. I mean different skills and aptitudes. Fortunately, we're enormously diverse. Because in evolutionary terms, a population which has got a narrow range of possibilities is likely to get stranded by changes in the environment. So the ability to adapt, you know, having diverse attributes, is what makes a species successful. And I heard some scientists joking the other day in a discussion, what happens if we have some kind of catastrophe in the way that you're describing? He says, well, the world, the most successful creatures will be cockroaches and rats. Why? Because they're enormously adaptable. They can eat practically anything, they explore their environment, and they're resistant to an awful lot of things. So they're very successful animals, and they will be out there possibly long after we're gone. And that might happen however we go. We will go eventually, of course. But the great thing about that, the evolutionary idea of humans, is that every human being has a value because they have a particular set of attributes and skills. And that we don't know now what skills and attributes are going to be valuable in the future. When we've got, we don't know what problems are ahead of us. We know there's some pretty nasty ones out there, and we're going to have to solve them. So developing humans as much as possible, human fulfillment, is an important, if you like, an evolutionary strategy. So we should value people. Now, that has huge implications for the way we value our individual humans and for the way we could structure our societies. And there's more than enough scope in that for another program sometime, but we're going to run out of time soon. But I'll just offer you a tiny little quotation from the late Carl Sagan, astronomer and writer. It says here, every one of us is precious in the cosmic perspective. And that's, you know, he's a great way with phrases. He goes on then, because we've talked about disagreements and cults and all sorts of other things before. He goes on, if a human disagrees with you, let him live. If in 100 billion galaxies, you will not find another. In other words, another human like that one. So that's human diversity. That's what he's trying to encapsulate in that. So don't extinguish people or subject people and prevent them from developing in that way. So I think there's a lot of positivity in there. Certainly looking in practical terms, which you quite rightly done today, we're not doing very well. We need to shape ourselves up and get organized to deal with that. So, but individual human fulfillment is important. And that sounds like a recipe for just everybody having a good time and sitting back and ignoring problems. That's not what's meant by that. It's not just sitting down, open another can and carry on. It's develop your skills and use them in the best way you can. Another little quotation, which would one of Huxley's actually, he refers to the duty. You have to remember Huxley died in 75 and was a bit of the old Raj about him. The duty to do something to develop his own personality, sorry about the pronouns, ladies, to discover his own talents and possibilities, to interact personally and fruitfully with other individuals, to discover something of his own significance. And in so doing, the evolution is realizing an important quantum of evolutionary possibility. I mean, nothing if not a little pompous. So in other words, you're contributing to the fulfillment and development of our humans. The idea of progress is an important one. Those of us who are basically optimists recognize the possibility of progress, but I don't think anybody is naive enough to think of the inevitability of progress. It's just not going to happen unless we do something about it.
And in fairness, there doesn't seem to be a lot being done that one could see with any great degree of certainty we're going to be all right.
I think that's right, and I think that's very sad, because we know what to do. We have the skills, even at this late stage, to do a lot of it. And the question is, why are we not doing that? One of the questions is, why are we not doing that? And you will have seen that little comment about the COP27 going on in Egypt, that there was a record number of lobbyists from the fossil fuel industries present at that. I wonder why.
Ah, yes, so do I. And I mean, you wouldn't want to be a notable academic to work it out, I would suggest, Mr. Tuffrey.
Correct and right.
Because, yep, as with most things, the bottom line is pound notes, arse pocket, as with everything around the world.
I'm afraid that's the case, yes, yes. Happily, people like me don't have very much money. I have enough, thank you very much. And I'm in a position not to worry about it. I can think beyond. I can think noble thoughts in my ivory tower in beautiful Ruhini. And incidentally, I know you can't see, you don't have a window in Studio One where you are, but the day is brightening up. You might get to your car without getting drowned.
Well, it'd make a change from the condition that I got out of it this morning to come in here. Alan, we will chat again, hopefully about something a bit lighter and brighter, if you'll pardon the pun, in 2 weeks' time, if we're all still here, that is.
Yeah, we will be, I think, yeah. All the best, Tony.
In the meantime, regular contributor Alan Tuffrey, thank you so much. Alan, it's been deep today now and dark, but, you know, there's no point in ignoring things either. Alan, chat to you in 2 weeks' time.
All the best. Slán.
Slán an chéile.
This is Near FM
90.3.